Welcome to Relevant Parties by Carhartt Work in Progress. I'm Chelle Ravens, and in this series, I'm going behind the scenes at some of the world's best independent record labels to meet the visionaries and the obsessives who've made musical history. In each episode, we sit down with one of these label founders to find out what makes them tick. We hear the tall tales and big ideas behind some of the most influential records and scenes of the past 30 years, and maybe try to work out just what possessed them to take on one of the most challenging jobs in the music industry. For a certain cohort of millennial ravers, Ed Banger was the gateway drug. In the early 2000s, it was the label that could lure the skinny jeans indie kids onto the dance floor with an ear-splitting fusion of electro, hip-hop, and straight-up rock and roll. A total aesthetic, mixing street art, logo t-shirts, sunglasses in the club, and a resolutely uncouth attitude. Some called it heavy metal disco, some called it bloghouse, but whatever it was, it constituted a movement. You had Mr. Wazo's outre spin on electro, Sebastian's legendary remixes, Justice taking electronic rock to absurd new heights, and Uffy rapping her way to alt-pop notoriety. Ed Banger, founder Busy P, was in the scene from the beginning. From before the beginning, in fact. Pedro Winter was a teenage skate rat listening to heavy metal and the Beastie Boys when he had his rave epiphany. And throughout the 90s, he was the driving force behind Paris's tight-knit, but soon to be massively influential club scene. His career is defined by two chance encounters with brilliant musical duos. A meeting with the young Thomas Bangalter and Guy Manuel de Homem Christo, which resulted in him managing one of the greatest electronic acts ever, and an introduction to Justice when they were still kids in leather jackets, ready to release the era's defining anthem, We Are Your Friends. Pedro dialed in from the basement of the Ed Banger office in Paris, surrounded by records, flyers, props of various kinds. Obviously, we ended up talking about Daft Punk a lot, because how could you not? And when we spoke, it was only a few weeks after they'd announced their split, which was an interesting time to get some personal reflections on the robot's influence, and indeed some never-before-revealed information about what goes on inside those helmets. But we also talked about the history of the Paris club scene and the boundless creativity of the late, great DJ Mehdi, who was so crucial to Ed Banger's success. Not to mention some wild parties and that whole thing where Daft Punk accidentally invented EDM. For an even richer listening experience, don't forget to queue up our Ed Banger playlist. Just search for Relevant Parties on Spotify and you'll be greeted with playlists for this and all episodes in both series so far. Now, it's time to apply your shutter shades. So Ed Banger is a label that, you know, means quite a lot to me because of the particular time that I got into dance music. And I guess I've been thinking a lot about how, you know, the things that make each label unique of all the labels that I've spoken to on Relevant Parties. And I think one of the things about Ed Banger that I kind of keep close to my heart is that you were kind of like a gateway drug. I think there's like a whole generation of kids who were maybe into other types of music who congealed and found themselves in the disco together in this really exciting time, which I think like the repercussions of that are kind of still playing out or have been playing out for a long time. I mean, there's a lot to talk about, but I wonder if we can maybe begin with that and this kind of idea that Ed Banger is almost like a rock and roll label in a kind of pure sense, right? It's like, it's about having fun and it's about youth to an extent, or it certainly felt like it was quite a young scene, like when it was first breaking through, and maybe it was kind of going against a slightly serious electronic vibe that was also existing at that time. Tell me a little bit about how you see Ed Banger as being not necessarily a dance label, but possibly a kind of broader, I want to say rock and roll. How do you feel about that?
First, thank you for the nice words, and I think you said it all, and I like and I love the fact to hear that Ed Banger Records means youth, mixed genre, party, freedom, generosity, and in your words, this is what I feel. And yes, the idea was to be a bit different than the other electronic music label, and the fact that the artists of the label were coming from different styles of music, and the fact that also we started the label in the early 2000 allow us to bring different people together. And exactly as you said, you know, and I often explain that to people, I feel just very lucky to be at the right corner. You know, I was there when the hip hop kids wanted to go to rave. We were there when electronic fans wanted to stage dive, and we were there exactly, you know, when the fan of the Strokes wanted to take ecstasy, you know, and and I believe we were there at the right time. Again, I feel very lucky. We didn't invent anything, you know. Like I have a lot of respect and love for Errol Alkan, too many DJs, James Murphy, all those people, you know, DJL in Germany, all those people, you know, gave us, you know, the energy to do what we've done. I hope we add some magic, some French magic on it, bringing, of course, my experience with Daft. All of this made a special cocktail. And again, it can only give me a goosebump to hear, you know, you like saying, oh, Ed Banger kind of opened me to electronic music. I have my first souvenir of this Justice Show or this DJ Medi set. I love the fact inside of people, we touch the heart of the people rather than being, you know, number one label or whatever. You know, I don't run my label to be a successful, you know, gold records and number one. I run my label to hear what you just explained, you know.
So for you personally, I believe that you ended up having a kind of similar route to some Ed Banger fans, where you started out listening to metal and you were a skater and you kind of had a rave epiphany, I guess. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling me a little bit about your kind of rave epiphany, like the first times that you stood in front of the big speakers and kind of had that feeling?
Yeah, I it was such a powerful moment. I have the date, you know, and I still have the flyer of the rave. It was in 1992 exactly, wow. A bit outside of Paris. And at the time, I knew about electronic music without knowing it. You know, like I was listening to dance music on the radio, mm-hmm. but as I was heavy metal and stuff, I kind of reject. You know, the smiley thing for us was kind of a joke. You know, coming from like a Metallica head, I was. You know, and and one day, like a friend of us, a skateboarder, took us. Like we were like, I think 10 of us, we went to a rave, to this huge warehouse, and we were 5,000 kids, totally free to do what we want, to dress as we want, to dance like we want, to stay up till whatever, you know. And it just smashed my head, and I loved it, and I embraced it very quickly, and I spent most of my weekend outside of Paris and into the raves. And the electronic music you can hear there was something you couldn't hear anywhere. You know, it wasn't dance music. It was a new genre. It was like, you know, techno and trance at the beginning, you know. And it smashed just my head. And I wanted to be part of this.
Was it unusual for a skate kid to get into dance music at that point? Or was that what some of your other kind of skater friends were doing too?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. Of course, you know, skateboard is affiliated with, you know, punk rock, you know, or speed metal, or really, you know, hardcore music. But in the 90s, it started to move to more like hip hop, you know, like because skateboard has always been in advance of like the youth culture. And at the beginning of the 2000s, skateboarders used to wear very baggy pants, you know, and stuff like that. So they were entering into the hip hop scene. So we had more and more hip hop in the skateboard videos. And of course, some of those skaters, especially the one, you know, from California, started to go out in raves and stuff like that. And the imagery, you know, like the of rave started to come into the skateboard culture. And so it was still like the early beginnings, you know, it was a weird move to go to a rave at that time.
Right, right.
And I like it.
Where are you actually from? Because is your family French? Because obviously Pedro Winter doesn't sound like the Frenchest name ever. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm totally French, born and raised in Paris. Pedro is a nickname. My real first name is Pierre, like a really French name. Winter is my last name. Winter is definitely my real last name. And Pedro just came from like my father used to live in South America. In Venezuela, exactly. And when I was going there, Pierre became translated by Pedro, and I kept it.
Well, there's already a DJ Pierre, you know.
And DJ Pierre was already exactly. In fact, DJ Pierre was my first CD. A friend of mine offered me the DJ Pierre CD just because my name was Pierre. He didn't know about Chicago or anything. And I have this CD now, and it's so precious for me. It was like the early Strictly Rhythm years of DJ Pierre. Just amazing.
Okay, let's have a moment in mid-90s Paris then, because there's a lot to get through, you see. So you were running the second room at David Guetta's night, right?
Yes.
Can you give me a bit of a sense of 90s France dance scene is kind of increasingly, I think, mythologized in lots of ways, you know, like I'm too young, but I kind of had this sense of what it might have been like. Tell me a little bit about what it was really like, because, for example, there was this burst of creativity with French DJs, producers. Was that something that, like, Paris was engaged in, like, together? Or are we talking about a tiny niche of people? Like, who's the crowd?
There is definitely, like, Paris, for people to know. It's a big city, but a very small village, you know, at the end, you know, like, it's a... we were all going to the same record stores. We were hanging out in the same raves, in same parties. So it's a small world at the end. And the fact that Daft Punk, you know, started to become famous in the UK kind of unleash the fact that people are shy to express themselves, you know. And for example, Air, which is a French band, you know, grew up at the same time as Daft Punk. You know, they were in the same neighborhood. The guy of Cassius at the same time, Saint-Germain, who wasn't from the same energy, did his project, you know, more like jazzy and house on his side. But at the end of the day, the whole group of French artists kind of emulate themselves. You know, it wasn't about competition, but more about like, it gives strength to all of the artists. So it was definitely something happening globally, you know, like I like to rethink the scene was trying to stick together, because I believe, you know, we were stronger together, and we kind of prove it a bit later. You know, we had those parties called Respect parties on Wednesday at Paris Queen, and every Wednesday night the whole Paris, you know, we wanted to listen to house music. And you had like a break dancers. It was in a gay club. So you had like a gay culture being invaded by breakers, skateboarders, yeah. House heads. And it was kind of unique. And, and we have to pay respect to those respect parties that was happening every Wednesday night in Paris. And this is where you could see the whole scene, all the DJs of Paris performed there. Then those parties traveled. They had like a residency in New York. They came to London. They traveled everywhere in Asia and everywhere. So yeah, there was definitely like a common and powerful like a creation coming from Paris.
I watched the film Eden last year. Did you see that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Did you recognize that kind of portrayal of Paris in the 90s?
Honestly, the movie wasn't a success, but it was super well done. And the French director, Mia Hansenlove, she did a brilliant job of also challenging herself to tell a story of someone who is not famous. I mean, she did the portrait of, I don't like the loser, but, you know, like someone not successful, you know, and I think that's touching and interesting. But she did pretty well done the spirit of the parties at that time. Yeah, I feel it was super well done, because she co-wrote the movie with a DJ from the 90s, a guy called Sven Love, who was definitely part of the scene at the time.
Yeah, I watched it. I didn't love it, partly because I felt like, I guess I was expecting it to be like, yay, let's go to Paris in the 90s and have a great time. And then like over time, the film is not having a great time.
So me neither. I was, I can't say I love the movie, but the thing that I respect is the choice, the fact today you can make not happy movie, you know, like, I mean, and a boring movie, you know, like, and yeah. I think that's interesting to, you know, if I had to do a movie about that time, it would be completely different.
I think yours would be more colourful, Pedro.
It will be definitely more fun, I think. But
it'd be more like 24-hour party people.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so we're speeding through the years. Either 95 or 96, you start managing Daft Punk, right? So party, 96. Daft Punk come along, they give you two tracks, and you decide, yep, I'm all in on this. And the three of you, who are all incredibly young at the time, go for it, right?
20 years old, yeah.
20 years old. All right, we're speeding through, but I wanted to ask a little bit about, so as the manager of Daft Punk, you kind of oversaw them signing a deal with Virgin, right? Yes. Virgin was the label, and it's interesting because Virgin is like this label that started out as, I guess, an independent label. But by the 90s, I don't think you could really call it any kind of indie, like it was a massive label. What kind of things did you learn from dealing with Virgin that you kind of took through to how you run Edbanger?
That's interesting. I don't think I took anything in particularly to run my label, because as you said, you know, Virgin is such a huge boat, and I am a small zodiac, you know, so I can't run like my indie label like you run a world company. But I have a lot of love and respect for the people I met during the time. And in fact, it's not a secret, the head of Virgin France at the time, which is Emmanuel de Burtel, he's my partner, he's still my partner today. And he launched his own indie label called Because Music. He's my partner since the beginning, not the beginning of Edbanger, but he jumped on the boat quite early, like 2005 or 2006. And I like, and I'm cherishing this relationship. I love loyal people. And it just showed me that you can be like the head of a world company, because after being Virgin France, he was also Virgin Europe and then EMI Europe boss. So he kind of run a big boat at the time. And he always trust and follow the Daft Punk craziness and project, like invest in more videos, invest in different marketing ideas, etc. And so I'm from the Virgin team at the time, but more into the fact of, always reinvest. And for example, on a small scale, but at Edbanger, the success of Justice allows me to do some smaller project and invest, you know, on smaller act, even if we don't sell much records. And I believe, you know, the label is 18 years old now. We started the conversation. You asked me how I was, and I'm feeling good because the foundation are strong, you know. And of course, there is a worldwide crisis, but since we have our feet on earth and well attached, because the company is solid, we can stand the crisis. And I've learned this from working with the Virgin team, that to create your business, you have to, you know, first consolidate the basis, and after that, you're growing up. So I don't know if I'm not talking about buildings. You know, I still have the same office for the past 20 years, and I like it like that. But I love the fact that, you know, the artist can count on us, and we are here, you know, to invest and create and believe in their projects. And this is how I run my label.
So, by the way, there might be things that I feel like I'm skipping over, but only because there are aspects of the story, including your story with Daft Punk, that are like, they're out there. You've told those stories. So I'm trying to maneuver to some new things. Clearly, in this period, late 90s, you are managing Daft Punk, who are becoming absolutely massive in a way that's, I think, is probably only even understandable from a distance, like looking back on the kind of impact. However, you were also running a party with DJ Mehdi at a club called Pulp.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Mehdi, because in terms of, you know, loyalty and friendship, and that is a foundation of the label. So when did you first meet Mehdi? What was your kind of initial friendship?
The initial friendship is dated because it was happening in New York City. We were doing like a crazy, you know, I told you about the respect parties just before.
No, yeah.
And those parties, they had a residency in a big club in New York called the Twilo, which was like a big, you know, very famous club in New York. And that night, Respect Party are throwing a party, and wait for it, Daft Punk, Cassius, Rob Anthony, and François Kevorkian.
Was Romantony singing with Daft Punk as well?
No, you know what, Charles? It was before. We are in 1998.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so Romantony was already a legend for us. You know, we were everybody in Paris, and I'm sure it was the same in London, was, you know, chasing like a new, his label was called Blackmail. So any new Blackmail record release was like kind of crazy because we only had 10 in Paris. And we met Romantony that time in New York. But to go back to your question, Cassius was playing in New York too. And Cassius, so Philippe Zdar and Boom Bass, they were also working in Paris for a big French act called MC Solar, which is like the biggest French MC. And a young kid was producing music for MC Solar, and the kid was DJ Mehdi. He was a hip-hop producer, but to a Daft Punk party. So they arrived in New York with Mehdi. We had a dinner together, and we didn't, we kind of felt in love, and we spent the last 13 years together. But the kind of the magic happened that night of March 1998.
Tell me then about what the kind of musical influences are in terms of what Mehdi's bringing and what you're bringing, where you kind of meet in the middle. Because one thing that's really occurred to me is that a lot of what people consider to be like the French sound, maybe not so much the kind of Bangalter type of French touch, but your sound, it's actually like really heavily in a hip hop and electro lineage, right? In terms of like sampling and in terms of like this, maybe the sort of textures, things like that. Like it's not strictly like, oh, it's house music that filters and dirty, whatever.
Again, you have the perfect approach. I introduce Moody Man or Kenny Dope to DJ Mehdi, and he pushed me into a Public Enemy or Eric B and Rakim, you know, even though I was already a hip hop head, you know, like we kind of exchange our passion, and very quickly we realize, you know, and in fact, just to go back on Mehdi, the fun fact, he introduced me, you know, like to, okay, if I knew Public Enemy, of course, but he was like, okay, you should listen to this one, you should listen. But also he invited me to listen to the Beatles or to Eric Clapton, which, you know, of course I knew, but I wasn't into it much, you know. And Mehdi was this unique guy being, he knew every lyrics of Public Enemy, but he knew every lyrics of the Beatles.
Wow.
And just to tell you, you know, the genius he was and the importance he had in our life at the time, because he was just like, when you're starting to pick music about him, then you realize like we were not ready for that. You know, he wasn't just like a guy, you know, making a boom bam beat for hip hop, you know. So to go back to what you said, exactly, Ed Banger, you know, we are an electronic music label because those are the tools we are using. But the music we put in those tools is coming definitely more from, you know, like a Timbaland or DJ Premier. You know, even, you know, DJ Premier, which is one of my favorite hip hop producer. I love to hear when people compare Sebastian, which is an artist from the label, the way he cut and chop the samples, they compare it to DJ Premier, you know. So often, like you did, people are comparing our sound or the way we produce more to the like hip hop producers than, you know, like a classic, you know, Carl Craig or legendary, you know, Jeff Mills, you know.
Yeah, and I think that applies a lot to Mr. Wazza as well. I mean, Quentin is like a huge hip hop, like when hip hop and electro were nearly the same thing, that sound is so important to what he does, yeah, I guess.
It's a good one because Mr. Wazza, for example, few people knows, but for me, he's more Madlib than any electronic producer, you know.
Yeah MPC kind of stuff, I guess, like the choppiness.
Exactly.
On that note, I just want to dig up one story that I know is publicly known, but it's just really, I love this. Jay Dilla sampled a Thomas Bangalter track. He didn't ask for permission though, did he?
No. So it was the first, I think we are back in 1999 and
Second Sun Village album, maybe.
I will say the first one, but I might be wrong. So we are in 1999. I'm already into Jay Dilla's sound. I don't know how come I discover his beats and stuff, but probably maybe of A Tribe Called Quest or, you know, like at the time, you know, they had this, the Huma. I don't know if it's like really like for the nerd. The Huma was the like a mega group, you know, with Q-Tip, Jay Dilla and few other producers.
Yeah.
And then JD catch my ears, and then I dig into it, and of course discover Slum Village, and one day Raise It Up, a track from a Slum Village appear. And to be honest with you, at the beginning, even though the sample is huge, the first listen I was just like, whoa, that song is amazing. But I didn't realize. And in fact, I have to give credit to Guy Manuel's brother. His name is Paul. And he listened to it. He was chilling at the office sometimes, at the Daft Punk office. And then he said, whoa, it sounds familiar. And then we quickly realized that JD sampled a Thomas Bangalter track, which the original was pretty techno and heavy. You know, it was on Tracks on the Rocks, yeah, when Thomas went really like Chicago style of house music.
Yeah, it's hard, dry.
And JD smartly and in a very classy way just unpitched the track and did like a crazy hip hop beats on it. And of course, we immediately spoke about it with the Daft Punk boys. And I told them that's the moment we have to catch the thing rather than, you know, calling a lawyer or whatever, which was no point. We decided to email him. So I spoke with Slum Village manager at the time in Detroit, and super nicely. I don't know if they were even embarrassed because my words were super friendly, you know, like, I told them, guys, yeah, we love you. No drama. Of course, you know, Daft Punk at the time starting to be a big thing. It was like the 2000, at the moment when Discovery, 2001, when Discovery was released. And I told them, okay, let's do a fair deal. And in fact, JD, the guy from Slum Village, and Karim Riggins, we have to shout out also Karim Riggins, who was also a JD La, brother in studio, all work together on this Daft Punk remix. And it's definitely one of the things that I'm the most proud of that I achieve as, you know, like working the Daft Punk team. But I was the one really insisting of doing it the cool way, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting as well, isn't it? Considering that you then have, like, because historically, you know, it's the artist sampling, maybe like a hip hop artist who has sampled something and then they get in trouble with someone who, you know, maybe just isn't really okay with sampling as a concept. Mm-hmm. But of course, Daft Punk were very okay with sampling as a concept. So it's not as though you could have been like, hey, you stole my music, because they understand the logic.
Of course. Yeah, the sampling game has never been like a problem, you know, for us. It's part of our culture and it's a two-way thing, right, you know. To continue just on this one, because that's interesting. After that, when Kanye West sampled, you know, like Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger to make Stronger, it was like the similar vibe. You know, we were, of course, super happy for it. Later on, when Swizz Beatz sampled a Justice song, you know, he sampled Dance for a track with Jay-Z. Same again, Kanye and Jay game for the Watch the Throne album. So it's amazing to see that your music is being sampled, you know, like, I know it's crazy.
Yeah. And it's cool as well. I mean, Daft Punk just have such impact, particularly within like the A-list of US hip hop, mm-hmm, you know, watching the reactions. I mean, we can get onto this later maybe, but seeing the kind of global reaction to last week's big news about Daft Punk splitting up, it's like, you realize like what a huge, you know, there are going to be a lot of people whose like only electronic album they have is Daft Punk. And it's because they're into like Kanye and stuff like that.
Definitely, yeah. No, that's crazy.
So there was a good quote in the long RBMA lecture that you did a long time ago that I wanted to kind of you did an RBMA lecture, I think, in 2009 or something.
With a crazy haircut.
Oh, did you? I was reading it.
I remember. Oh, yes. I'm glad you didn't watch it, because I tried something before and it wasn't a good idea. I tried like some Oasis haircut for I don't know why.
I kind of always imagine that this is the haircut that you've always had. This is your look.
Yeah, but
right?
Not the one on the Red Bull.
Now I'm going to have to check it out.
Yeah.
Anyway, you were asked something about Daft Punk and you described them as being the kings of no, and that one of the kind of secrets to their success in a way is just being able to simply say no to things, not necessarily for any reason other than they just don't want to do them, they don't feel the pressure. And I guess I wanted to think about that for a label that's trying to, you know, make its way. How did you kind of absorb that lesson? I guess I'm curious about if there's anything that you ever said no to that you later wish that you hadn't, that you wish that you had in fact said yes to.
Oh yeah, yeah. you mean with Edbanger or with Daft Punk?
Well, both maybe, but with Edbanger, but both.
Yeah, no, with Edbanger, there is something I regret, of course, but that's life. Bruno Mars wanted to make some music with Breakboat.
Oh wow!
And
but did he? Didn't he basically just kind of get inspired by the song instead of?
Yeah, but
is that what happened?
This we realized later. So it's good to inspire people, but. I regret we missed the boat at the time. Of course, it's easy to say now because the story is written, but Breakboat was working on his new, on his first album. So we said, oh, sorry. And Bruno Mars didn't release nothing before, you know? So we were, oh, sorry. The two of them could have done crazy, crazy music. But that's one thing.
Just to explain that Bruno Mars then released a track, I can't actually remember what it's called now, that's like heavily inspired by the track that he might have done with Breakbot, right?
Exactly, kind of the same chord than Baby I'm Yours from Breakbot.
Yeah.
But that's part of the game, you know, so this is why, sure. You know. But on the Daft Punk side, I can, you know, like, I can only respect their choices, you know. But we met, you know, Bjork, Janet Jackson, all those people at the time, and inside of me, I was burning like, wow, guys, imagine you and Bjork. You know, because me, I always, you know, again, I was lucky to be in the Daft Punk bubble at the time, but I never left my fan position. Mm. You know, I loved everything they were doing. And I was in the center of this. And when I got the Bjork team calling me, oh, Pedro, Bjork is in town. She want to meet you guys. So we go to her hotel room. And inside of me, I'm like, whoa, because I'm a big fan of Bjork. And I was like, okay, let's make it happen. Let's make it. And at the moment I'm telling them, they say, oh no, we have to concentrate on our project. We have to work on this. We have to do that. So they're already killing me. So the king of no, in fact, it was an article in a English magazine. A guy did a piece on me and I told them my job is to say no to everybody. And he named me the king of no.
Right. Okay.
And because I was saying no, you know, like it's funny because the other day, you know, since Daft Punk announced the fact that they will not make music anymore together, I'm kind of, we are in my basement right now, literally. It's my studio, and also in the back there are some boxes filled with the souvenirs, flyers, etc., etc. And the other day, I was like, okay, let's open one of those boxes I didn't open for 15 years or something. And I found some faxes that I signed, you know, to George Michael team or to Janet Jackson.
Oh, wow.
So one day I will have to scan them and it's going to be funny to realize like we turned down a lot of exciting projects.
We can move into the 2000s now. So you started Edbanger by the sounds of it, basically because you were kind of fed up with managing. You didn't want to manage any more people, at least. And you heard a track by Mr. Flash called Radar Rider that you thought,
yes,
let's put this out. And then quite soon afterwards, you met Justice, who gave you their track. And you thought, yes, I want to put this out too. And that track is obviously We Are Your Friends. Tell me about the kind of beginnings then of Edbanger and how those two tracks helped you think about what the label was going to be. Like, did you actually have a clear vision for the kind of music you wanted to put out? Like, was it a reaction to other things that you felt were lacking in France or?
No, I had absolutely no vision, you know. what I mean is that the day I proposed Mr. Flash to release his music, when I woke up in the morning, I didn't know I will release a record or launch a label that day, you know. So no, I'm totally honest with you. It's totally spontaneous. And even today, you know, I'm still, you know, like 18 years later, I'm still do everything I do in a spontaneous way. And the fact that, you know, Mr. Flash came to see me with this track, which sounded like a bit like a DJ Shadow hip hop.
Yeah, it's very hip hop, really.
Yeah, it's an instrumental hip hop. And me, as a big fan of Mowax and James Level and DJ Shadow, of course, I kind of like, okay, this is the French way. This is how I want to do it. And so I decided to release this music. But then few weeks after, I meet the Justice Boys and they play me Never Be Alone, the remix of the Simian, the indie band Simian. And I fall in love right away. And I tell them, come to my office the next day. We're going to release this. And I didn't know them. I met the guy in a dinner. The label was nothing. It was Never Be Alone will become the second release of the label. And it has nothing to do with Mr. Flash music.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
So I can't really say about vision, or maybe my vision was a blurry thing. Let's put out records and we'll see what's going on. So maybe that's why that was my vision. But so we launched the label like that. At the time, I was, of course, still working for Daft Punk and I was working for Cassius, for DJ Mehdi already. And I think, you know, inside of me, Thomas and Guiman of Daft Punk, they had their own label. You know, Thomas got Roulé and Guiman has Cri d'Amour. Maybe inside of me, I said, oh, they have their own imprint. I should have mine too. You know, I think we, with the time and again, the experience, I wanted to create my my own thing. So, yeah, so I did it again, very spontaneous way. And I like also the parallel with skateboarding, which is a culture that really is important to me. When you have like 6 or 10 stairs in front of you, if you think too much, you will not go, you know, you will not jump over, because the only thing you will think of is, oh, I'm going to break my my neck. And and I think it's the same for me, for the label. You know, if you think too much, oh, I'm going to lose money. Oh, there is no more record store. Oh, there is the DJ. Oh, there is the streaming. You will not move. So, I launched my label a bit this way, you know, like, let's do this. Let's ollie this music business.
Was it you that came up with the phrase heavy metal disco? I don't know where that came from, but it seems to have followed you around a little bit.
Heavy metal disco? No, I don't know. No, it's not coming from me. Or maybe I did. I don't know. No, I don't know if it's me. Yeah, but it's perfect. It's exactly, you know, who we are. And of course, the image. Of course, people, heavy metal because of the cross of justice and the fact they wear a leather jacket and stuff. And we play loud music and the Marshall amps on stage. And disco because we love Nile Rodgers and Giorgio Moroder, you know. So there is a mix and a confrontation of two worlds, which, you know, needed to be taken by a label, and Headbanger is born for that.
Yeah. Did you feel as if that sound kind of spontaneously formed and multiplied as new artists joined the label, or was there some other kind of, was it that once a couple of people had done it that there were sort of copycat people, or like I'm trying to work out like why it was at this moment produced this sound, which now you listen back and it does sound like that time. And I just wonder, like, is it because people heard Justice and tried to do that, or was there something a bit more like in the waters, like somehow people were moving towards it?
Yeah, I think let's not be too pretentious. I think it was definitely something in the air. You know, I don't like the word, but it means something. The, you know, what they call the blog house. I don't know if you're familiar. You know,
I'm far too familiar with blog house.
I'm sorry if you invented it.
I was merely swept up in it.
Okay, but I don't like this word, but it means something.
Right,
it means something. The fact that MySpace arrived in our life, it was a way, you know, for all of us to connect together, to create a link, a bridge between Paris and Los Angeles, Paris and London, you know, Mastercraft in Canada.
Yeah.
Again, you know, Errol in London. It means something, you know, it was the beginning. People need to understand, of course, we're in 2021 now, but let's go back 15 years later. It wasn't as easy, you know, to express yourself, to exchange music, you know, like we didn't have all those Dropbox and WeTransfer and MySpace was a pretty crazy window for us, you know, with this little music player. You could play, you know, 4 tracks. You choose your 8 friends in your top 8 friends, and it meant something. And also, you know, we were joking together with the artist, they had access to our real life. People who felt really like, oh, they are my friends. They are speaking they are, you know, like speaking in front of us. There was something like a real, when we were talking about community, it felt, it means something. And the fact that the music traveled that fast helps a lot. So yeah, so to go back to your question, yes, I think something was in the air. And again, to go back to the earlier of what we were saying, spank rock was a hip hop guy going to wanted to party. Then the Simian guys, they already wanted to make electronic music. Mm. So they start to get rid of their guitars and amps and buy a drum machine and samplers. Mm. So something like something was in there. And Justice wanted to be Black Sabbath rather than being the new Daft Punk, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So that's and also to give credit also to Gigolo Records in Germany, you know, they had the big Electro Clash thing, which definitely was more electronic orientated, you know, because it was really like krautrock, Kraftwerky, you know, sounds, without the funk. And of course we brought the funk back into this thing, and this is what makes, you know, Headbanger the right, you know, bridge, and doing this relevant parties project with a car makes sense to me, being next to a Ghostly or, you know, or Stone's Throw, for example. You know, exactly.
We are the
missing link, you know.
So
I was really proud and honored when the Michael and the team called us to be part of this project together.
Let's talk a little bit about the visual side of Headbanger, because definitely, I mean, there have been some labels in my series so far that have got very strong visual identities, but Headbanger is definitely way up there, something that you've obviously always been quite interested in. And you've worked with some people specifically, like, I don't know if it's pronounced So Me or if it's...
So me, like, you know, it's a French guy, but he's called So Me because when he was showing his art, he was like, oh, it's so me.
So, and I think if I'm not mistaken, I think he comes from like a graffiti kind of background, right? So it kind of brings that edge.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And also you have put out a huge amount of memorable and varied music videos. And I notice, you know, like digging around in some of the more recent releases, you're still doing that for new records. You're still doing really cool, interesting, unique music videos. Tell me a bit about the kind of visual identity and how much you control it, like what it's meant to be about. And then I guess if we could also talk a bit about music videos, because they occupy a strange position now that everyone is like streaming things all day long, but they don't work like they used to.
I agree. I'm a kid from the 80s. So
MTV kid.
And most MTV kid, pop culture, Steven Spielberg, Indiana Jones, Star Trek, you know, and also, you know, we are, of course, French and European, but starting, you know, to get the influence from the United States, and this pop culture, which is a beautiful world for me, means something, means that you can make beauty of what is global, what is, you know, mainstream. And so imagery, communication has always been very important to us. And of course, since the beginning, I put the image at the same level as the music. Of course, we are music label, but for me, I wasn't ashamed to say that the record needs to sound well, but needs to look good too. And this is what we've done with So Me, as for the record sleeve to be recognizable. When you enter a record store at the time, you knew, oh, this is the new Headbanger, because it was handwritten, it was handmade or whatever. And but at the same time, So Me managed to do an imagery for DJ Mehdi and a different imagery for Justice.
Yeah.
And both of them were completely different.
Mm.
And same for the video. For the video, again, I have to send love to the Daft Punk boys. They told me since the beginning, let's work with the best one. We work with Michel Gondry, Roman Coppola, Spike Jonze, Seb Janiak. We work with a lot of different artists and invest a lot of money at the time in videos.
Yeah.
But videos, it's true that, you know, in the 90s or early 2000s means something, because the music television still exists.
Yeah.
Not anymore. But I love it as an art, you know, like for me, you express yourself, not in music, but in video. And it's a piece of art itself. And this is why we continue to do it with Justice. You know, we give a chance to Somi to do his first videos with us, Romain Gavras, Alice Moitié, which is a French upcoming photographer that you will see soon, from her. She's going to be very talented, and she's working a lot of our recent videos. Videos is the continuity of an album for me. Once the artist is out of his studio, when he creates the videos, for me, he's doing like extra tracks, you know, and this is why we give it so much attention. And again, it's funny what you say, streaming, attention of people. People are, when there is a new album, they are listening to it one day, and then the next day, when is the next one coming? But again, we are not slaves of this planning or this crazy schedule. We do videos, even though people, they look at their phone, 15 seconds stories. We try to invite them to our world to go, okay, take your time, go watch this video, trust us, you know, and this is what the most precious with Ed Banger and his community is, that the people are trusting us and they are following us for 18 years now.
Let's talk also about the way that Daft Punk especially had such an impact on how dance music is experienced visually, particularly with the Alive tour in 2007, which is one of the biggest regrets of my entire life, is that I did not go to that.
Oh, you didn't see any of the show?
I knew I was making a mistake even when it was happening. I was like, I should probably be going to this. And then it's honestly, I regret it more with every passing day, to be honest.
Shall you're in London, huh?
Yeah, I think they played it. I think they played in Hyde Park or something, right? It was like a huge one.
We did Hyde Park, exactly. Yeah,
I remember that I didn't go. It was It was an important tour for lots of reasons, and I think it would have been huge and famous had it simply been, you know, a hit in Europe. But I think really you can make a strong argument that when Daft Punk took that tour to America, they unleashed a very powerful force that later became EDM, possibly. Because there were people who saw that show, like, I think, Skrillex, people like that, who...
Yeah, this is what I wanted to tell you. The best answer is coming from Skrillex.
Right. So did he see it at Coachella, maybe? Was that when
He was there. He was there in 2006. We didn't know each other at the time, but later on I met him, of course.
Yeah.
And he told me, watching Daft Punk live, I decided to start to make music.
I guess the thing is, what they showed was that you could make dance music into a live experience in a way that perhaps people hadn't fully grasped yet, right? And I mean, it comes back to the heavy metal disco thing as well, in a sense, isn't it? It's like, how do you make two guys standing over some machines into like an epic experience? And I think that's probably the show that like proved it the most at that time.
Exactly. It was a musically like a crazy performance, because they had like three albums out at the time. So putting the three albums together and make it like a crazy medley sonically was something unbelievable. And as you said, how, you know, like two guys behind computers. Of course, Kraftwerk did it better than anyone else.
Let's be fair here. Kraftwerk did do this also.
This is why I'm mentioning Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
And Daft Punk had the power to create a visual piece that break boundaries at the time. Let's go back, you know, 14, 15 years ago. All those walls of LEDs and lights, they were not that common. Mm. You know, today you can get LEDs in a Nottingham nightclub, without dissing Nottingham, but you know, like we had to rent all the LEDs from Belgium to do the Coachella show. You know, like it was crazy, like ambitious. I mean, technically, you know, and what they did in the Coachella desert, yeah, they proved that electronic act could be a main stage or an headliner. You know,
yeah.
And the next year, you had like an electronic band headlining Coachella.
I have a question about Daft Punk and that show, though, which is that, can they see through their helmets to see what they're doing? Because it doesn't look like they can.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But it's it's completely fully tinted. I was looking at it on the like clips from the Alive tour, and I was just like, what if they're just not doing anything, and they're just, or do they have like a separate like screen thing inside the helmet? But okay, I believe you.
No, they can see, and I can even share with you a little secret. They even add a little fan inside the helmet.
That also makes sense, because the rest of their outfit is like leather. So they must be super hot, because they'd be wearing those biker jackets.
They were sweating. Yeah. Exactly. So we put some fan into the mask.
Inspired. Okay. I want to move to sort of 2006-ish. So because we're talking about Daft Punk, but like Justice... Sorry, I should say Justice, really, shouldn't I? So this was always a big argument at the time of like, if you were a true Ed Banger head, then you would say Justice.
Justice.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about Daft Punk, but Justice sold more records in France than Daft Punk at that time, right? In 2006. They were huge, like truly, truly huge.
Yeah, I mean, the first album was a pretty big success, yeah. and their single Dance was like on every rotation on the radio. Mm. So yeah, definitely, like we are in 2007.
Oh yeah, okay.
We are 2007, and this is the end of the Daft Punk tour and the beginning of the Justice era.
Yeah, you must have been quite tired at that point. You'd just done like this huge tour, and then suddenly your own label is just like going crazy.
It was, of course, a non-stop journey, you know, between Daft Punk and Justice. But at the beginning, we managed to have like a parallel road. And for example, while Daft Punk was on tour in the US, I had Justice DJing at the same time. So I was able to do both, you know. And the energy was good. In fact, Thomas and Guiman were kind of big brothers of Xavier and Gaspar. Mm-hmm. They get along quite well. We did few cross interviews in France. It was really fun till Justice starting to be big, and till the time Daft Punk started to finish the tour and come back to Paris and think about the future. And of course, I was more involved with the Headbanger Project and Justice than with Daft Punk. And especially because it was, when you work with a band, the in-between two albums sometimes can be a bit, I feel useless. Mm. So this is why I definitely jumped into the Headbanger. And we decided with Daft Punk to end our collaboration, which was like a 12 years collaboration, which was amazing. Very naturally, I moved and I focused on Headbanger. And then this is why I sang Justice. We released DJ Melly's first album. Yep. We sang Sebastian, Mr. Oiseau came in, Breakboat, etc., etc. And I created something. The other day, when Daft Punk announced their separation, I said like, yeah, it was a big heritage, you know, to carry, and a big responsibility. And I think Headbanger was my answer to this heritage. Like, okay, they did something big. Sorry, so let me do something as big as possible, and it's Headbanger. So I'm not saying it's as big as Daft Punk, but it needed to be as strong, you know.
Mm. Well, this was a fun time. Basically, there were a lot of great records and some good parties, and I was definitely at some of them. Could you just describe, perhaps, let's say, the wildest party that you can remember from this era, the most fun party that you can remember from this era, if you can remember any?
Wow. Okay. One of the wildest. I wanted to keep this one for a book, but you're sympathetic, Charles.
Give us a preview.
I can share with you. This one especially is interesting because it was a Daft Punk after party. Daft Punk performed live in Toronto 2007.
Okay.
And at the same time, we did an after party with Sebastian, Kavinsky, me and some other DJs. And it was, for me, the reunion of course, the Daft Punk and the Headbanger family. So we did the Daft Punk show.
Where did you say it was? In Toronto?
Toronto.
Great.
Yes.
Okay.
In Toronto, Canada.
Yeah.
And then we did the after party, like in a club called the Mod Club, which is sadly closed now, but we had like some amazing parties there. People went crazy. And of course, in Toronto, what I like is that after the after party, there is the after party. Like R. Kelly used to say. I know it's very bad to quote R. Kelly, but fuck it.
Yeah, well, he was right about that one particular thing, I guess.
This one, he was right. Mm. And then we ended up in a kind of a student apartment, but pretty well organized. And we did a crazy party with the Daft Punk guys, of course, unmasked.
Oh, yeah.
Sebastian and Kavinsky, fooled of probably 5 bottles of vodka each. And I ended up dressed as a girl. So it was a pretty crazy party.
Who gave you their clothes?
A girl I met. And she wasn't shy. And if I remember well, I lost my phone, which never happened to me. Yeah, so you have the... I let you imagine the rest, but
did Daft Punk actually play as well? Is that the idea?
At the after party,
or were they just hanging around?
No, they hanging out. They just hang around. Mm. Yeah, they didn't play. No, one of the other wildest one is when Thomas DJ with me for my birthday in Los Angeles at CineSpace. I don't know if you've seen recently a lot of videos pop again. We were DJing, DJ Mehdi, me and some other friends at CineSpace in Los Angeles. And I was DJing and Mehdi went to see Thomas and told him, okay, it's Pedro's birthday. Go on the decks. And he played like Rolling and Scratching from Daft Punk and Prince. I think which one from Prince? I don't remember the song from Prince, but people went crazy because for like 1 minute, in front of the people were like, oh, who is this guy? And then one guy said, oh, that's Thomas of Daft Punk. And then the club went mental. So yeah, but I will keep some more details for the book.
For the book. So when's the book?
When is the book? I don't know. But to be honest, I used to say as a joke, but for a few months now, I'm really thinking about it.
Definitely.
And because in 2023, we're going to be 20 years of Headbanger. And I think it's a good timing to tell about Headbanger as we are doing now. And also since, Daft Punk doesn't exist anymore, I think it will make something interesting, from Daft Punk to Headbanger to do what's next.
Yeah. Well, I strongly agree. Definitely. All right. So one thing that happened to Headbanger, which is perhaps a little bit unusual that not all labels will have gone through, is that you really were like an it label for several years. You were like label of the year for a few years running. Huge. And also, part of a specific kind of youth cultural, pop cultural moment, a wave. But of course, nobody can be that it label forever. So things change. I'm kind of wondering, like, how did you deal with the come down from that whole period and the inevitable sort of copycat artists and things like that? What were the years after that explosion like for you?
Now I have to show off a little bit, but
please do. My
one of my strengths is to be patient. That's what I've learned with Daft Punk, is that patience is the key. And exactly as you said, when we were Label of the Year in Herb magazine in 2007, in Accelerator in 2008, it felt good and it makes sense at the time. And then, of course, some years you go a bit quieter or you release some music that don't get the same attention. But I believe it's been a few years now that we get attention again. And I think it's also due to the age of our community, some people are telling me, I didn't know about the 2006 era. I'm discovering just right now, the younger crowd.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to work again to excite a new generation. And I'm not against being Label of the Year in 2021, but to go back to the core of your question, you have to accept the game and to be patient, as you can feel now, we are not running after being cool or number one. We just do things, except when you have to be a bit in the shadow at some times, shine again. The label life, when you say you are a hit label, I know we did some pretty good songs and project, but we are far from, like the big mainstream hit labels. But I think what people like is our story, which is musically, personally, what we reflect, what we look like, the fact that our little family. And also there is a lot of good feelings and good attention from the people. The fact that we lost DJ Mehdi and Philippe Zdar of Cassius.
Yeah.
Between our fans and us, a lot of compassion, but in a good way, we are not looking for people to cry on our shoulder. We are, but people relay to us. I don't know if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And in a way, there is something, a true family or friendship link that makes our relationship special and by the fact make the label special.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe this.
When Mehdi died in 2011, which amazingly is 10 years ago, which is very strange to think. Did you always want to carry on with the label without him?
No, the next few days, of course, no. I was like, I was totally lost, especially, but more a personal thing. It was the first time I was seeing death. You know, like I lost my grandparents, which is natural, you know. But 2011 was the first time I was confronted. So I was completely lost. Wow. So of course, continue the label was like a question, but quickly the energy came back and maybe in a philosophy or way, like I wanted, you know, to make the label shine again for him, you know, and because he was very, very attached to the, to the label, and we were the two, you know, of us, really representing the label, you know. Then quickly I decided, okay, let's continue. Of course, it was a bit hard. And, you know, when you mentioned about, you know, the low time of the label, it makes sense. I totally accept it. And I'm not taking this as an excuse, you know, like I'm not saying, oh, guys, give us a break. We were completely devastated. So maybe we lost a few years to, you know, to go back, you know, to find the energy again, to do a project and stuff. But I'm, you know, it's one of the sad days of our life we had to cross. And now, as you said, you know, it's been 10 years. So I'm thinking, we are thinking of releasing a project, some unreleased music I have from Mehdi. I would love some people to revisit his first album also, because Mehdi passed away 10 years ago and we released his first album 15 years ago. So we continue. We often, you know, he's with us every day. I'm not, you know, like we started this interview in an optimistic way. And every time I'm speaking about Mehdi, it's always with joy and smile. You know, there is no, the drama was on the day of the accident. And since then, there is no more drama. You know, it's all about, you know, life. And let's try to, again, very personal. But since then, I was already optimistic. But since then, I'm like, I am in the team of let's enjoy life as much as you can. So let's get rid of, I don't waste my time in a problem or stuff like that.
And you mentioned Philippe briefly as well, who we should also kind of raise a glass to Philippe of Cassius, because I feel like he's almost like a bit of a, well, not like a secret star of the Parisian scene, but was, you know, was a huge presence, but perhaps isn't so well known.
Exactly. True. You're completely right. He was more a man of the shadow first, because as his job as a music producer or sound engineer, he's behind the window. He's not the artist. And working with the Beastie Boys, Cat Power, Phoenix, Kindness. He did the last project he worked with was for Hot Chip, the last album. He made the last Hot Chip album. And first, he was very talented as a sound engineer. As an artist, he did Cassius, but also few people know because it's way back. He released Motor Bass, which was one of the first electronic album from France, which is for me the milestone. It was before Daft Punk. It's the, for me, it's like it's a diamond, you know. And personally also, he was a very intense and handsome man. And very generous, and exactly like Mehdi, they were like people who bring people together. Again, we had to cross this all together. We realized that we were strong. You know, we had like a big family around us. A lot of people show us love and support. It means so much. You know, it means that of course people love them. And also, they were very good. People took good care of us.
Right. Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
And again, that makes our story special. You know, again, you know, like I'm touching wood for this not to happen anymore. But that's life. And same, we continue. You know, we have some music project to share again. Philippe was someone who enjoy life more than anyone else. I'm happy to continue and take this heritage of let's enjoy life as much as you can.
So you got back to production yourself a few years ago with the Maya Hawthorne track, which is like a real pop song, you know, a pop song. But still, I mean, it's
Wait for the next one.
Oh, okay. And I was thinking about how, I mean, obviously it's quite obviously a pop song from your world, I think, but it's a pop song. Thinking about how Justice kind of turned deeper towards this slightly like classic sound, I guess, on Woman. Daft Punk went down that kind of route on Random Access Memories of wanting to make like this, like a studio sound, maybe thinking about the way that Sebastian is making these kind of like concept pop albums. I was wondering a little bit about this kind of, if there's a connection in that shift, if it's kind of a result of like, you know, growing up a bit, not wanting to be like in the mosh pit or in the middle of the dance floor anymore, do you think?
Yeah, but there is definitely something linked to the age, and there is this ambitious of trying to move things above, you know, I mean, when I'm saying above, making people dance, making people jump, making people cry. We know how to do it, you know, producing dance records or club records or stuff like that. We know how to do it, but making songs, you know, to be played on radio, being played on an airplane, or, you know, like we manage to do it sometimes, but not all the time. And so this is our way to do it, not trying to fit what people can expect, you know, from the pop world. But I don't think too much. It's the next song I'm releasing in June. It's true that for once I said, okay, I want a singing format, you know. There is still a lot of instrumental into it, but I wanted it to be a song, A side, and the B side will be an hip hop track. So I still, you know, I still feel free to go where we want. You know, this is we are not format yet, you know.
Do you think that there's an element of striving to reach those kind of higher heights and making that perfect pop song and making that kind of ultimate music that everyone can enjoy?
Of course, this is our like the dream or goal or objective. Of course, this is every musician wants to reach, you know, the popularity or like the. But there is a way of doing it, and rather you do like very cheesy way, you know, like the top 40 way. When I'm listening, you know, sometimes, for example, some of the Calvin Harris songs, you know, because he's definitely a number one hit maker. Some of them are very well produced and super well done, you know, like, and this, you know, we can only be happy for him to be number one because he deserves it. And musically, it's very good. Sometimes, even though he's my friend, when I'm listening to David Guetta's number one, you know, I'm not too much happy with it, like, you know, it's so you can't be happy all the time. So yeah, we are all chasing to make the perfect pop songs, but you know, there is sometimes some nice accident when you listen to Groove Is in the Heart from Delight back in the 90s, you know, like it was like a freaky weirdo band from New York doing a crazy club tracks, and we can only be happy that they were number one, you know. You look at Frank Ocean, Blondie became number one, and the record is a piece of art, you know. So there is always a way to bring your creativity at a certain point. Daft Punk did it.
I wonder, like Daft Punk really did do it, and if they hadn't already done it by the time of they got to Get Lucky, then Get Lucky did it, right? Like that's, you know, I kind of wonder if, do you think that's something to do with the reason that they've decided to stop making music together? Like they've just kind of completed it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. To be honest with you, I don't have any more info about the fact that why they decided to, but it just, I think, you know, they've been doing music 28 years together. Maybe at some point, you know, they were not, you know, going in the same direction. You know, sure. So that's the only real response, I guess. You know, like, but it's not about I don't think they achieve, you know, like a certain level and then look at it and say, oh, we've done it all. let's give up. I don't think so. Not this kind of artist, you know.
Yeah.
And what proves it is that they will make music separately.
Yeah,
so
right.
They still have stuff to say. And who knows? Maybe Thomas Mangalter will have a number one record even bigger than Get Lucky in 2 or 3 or 5 years. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It seems possible. It seems possible. All right. Final question. I mean, lockdown has gone on a long time. And I think now that the end is possibly in sight, I don't think it's as simple as it was where we were all just desperate to be in the club again. Like it's going to be a weird thing to be back in a club with people and whatever. Please describe what your perfect return to the club would be like. What is your perfect party comeback? What are the necessary ingredients for you?
First ingredient, I need my daughters to be with their grandmother. I need to make sure they're safely hidden away. safely out of the apartment for the next 48 hours.
Okay, you got that.
First thing, I need to arrange the family business. Then I think me and my girlfriend will get drunk hard. And we are not big drinker, but honestly, I know it's stupid to say that, but because I should say about music first, but no, we definitely want to get a bit,
drunk. What's your drink of choice?
For gin and tonic, anything with vodka. I'm more into white alcohol.
Clear spirits,
exactly.
Okay, yeah.
But the party, honestly, we'll see, you know, it's a tricky question because I'm not too, even though I'm an optimistic guy, will we party during the summer or will we go back to clubs early winter, you know? And it makes a difference because if we are in the summer, of course, we can find some outdoor parties, t-shirt, sweat, walking back home at 7 in the morning when the day is coming up. And this is a different thing than going to a club while it's snowing, going back home with a big puffy jacket, sweaty, and you lost your keys in the club. But I don't know. But what I mean is that honestly, anywhere it can be in any club. You know, like the lineup for sure will be crazy because all the DJs will be available.
Oh yeah,
everybody will want to DJ.
Yeah,
I will DJ for free. I will DJ for 6 hours if someone asks me. Like,
put that out. So, who would you have DJing if it was your choice of lineup as well as you
in Paris?
Yeah. Well, they don't have to be from Paris, just a dream lineup.
Wow. Oh, dream lineup.
Yeah, go on.
Wow. Okay, dream lineup.
They have to be like a present day person, though. You can't say like Frankie Knuckles.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Those are the rules.
Okay. I didn't think about it. A crazy lineup. I will definitely ask Laurent Garnier a favor because I have to send love to him because we didn't mention his name during our talk and he's definitely a key person in our
we skipped over that era a bit, didn't we? I'm afraid.
No, but it's interesting because of course he was there before us, but he's still here today, and you know we are doing some project together, and I love watching him DJ. I even had the chance to DJ with him. So I will book Laurent Garnier for sure.
Great.
I love when I told you about loyalty. Personally, also, I have the same loyalty for the artists I love. And I love them in 1995 and I love them in 2021. I would love to have Louis Vega and Kenny Dope together again as Masters at Work.
Yes, so, that would amazingly good. That would be exactly the right vibe as well for the comeback, wouldn't it? You know, just like that's the mood that you want to recreate. Yeah. The kind of peak Masters at Work, just
oh yes. And for my hip-hop heads, I would love to bring back DJ Premier because he's the guardian of the temple of hip-hop, New York style, boom bap rap, which I love. And in a more to finish, because all those names are, you know, from the past, from the past and the present, but let's find some artists from the future. I will book Mead because Mead not only is a good headbanger, is a new headbanger artist, but also he's a very good DJ and he's the future. And I think it's always interesting to not to forget, you know, like, of course, the young artist, and also Shal, because people are going to be crazy at me. I will book Cherelle to represent our female DJs. And because Cherelle, I saw her DJ and I love the energy. She has the music she plays is full of energy, and the way she's playing it is also incredible. And I love people. Mehdi was like that. When you look at them dancing, jumping all around, it's crazy. So that's a pretty good lineup. I think we can sell tickets. We can do a pre-sale right now.
It's going to be kind of expensive. Do you think you can? Actually, no. You're right. Everyone's going to want to play for like no money because they're just desperate.
Exactly.
Great. Get in there now. Pedro, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Shal.
You've been listening to Relevant Parties from Carhartt Work in Progress. If you want to dive into more music from the labels in this series, check out the Relevant Parties playlist on Spotify. You can find the link in the show notes. And remember, you can subscribe to Relevant Parties so that you never miss an episode. It's available wherever good podcasts are found. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and a comment on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to know what you think. So thanks for listening, and join me next time for more stories behind the world's best record labels.